Good afternoon, everybody. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare, Human Service, and Rural Health Policy. I'd like to call us to order. It is Wednesday, February 1st. This is considered an informational hearing because we didn't have, we had our first opening day today, I couldn't have it as a public hearing. So just realize that we're doing a lot of our work on some of these bills now, and so that we won't have to spend much time and pass them out as soon as we can.
Maybe.
So with that, I would like to open an organizational meeting and have the adoption of committee rules.
Bang your gavel, Fendi. Madam Chair, I move adoption of the proposed committee rules dated 2-1-12.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today, 2-1-2012. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Well, clerk better call the roll since not everyone's here.
Senator Lee?
Excused.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chairwoman Sanderson?
Aye. Motion passes and the rules are adopted. Thank you, committee members. We have Senator Shields and Senator Bates, who will be here shortly. And of course, we have our same cohorts, Senator Cruz and Senator Morse. Do any of you have any comments before we get into the meat of everything?
Let's go to work.
All right. With that, I'd like to open an informational meeting on relating to flu vaccine, and I'd like to call forward Jack Dempsey and Patty O'Sullivan might as well come too. And this has to do with Senate Bill 1503. Jack, take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Jack Dempsey with the Oregon Nurses Association. I was just thinking back, this is four sessions in a row now that we've discussed this issue before this committee. Senate Bill 1503, which you heard just a couple weeks ago, and I'll just be brief and reiterate a couple things on here. It takes what we've seen work at some of the healthcare facilities in the state, which is a good education campaign with the declination form, and runs that statewide. It defines healthcare facilities broadly. It defines healthcare worker broadly to grab everyone who comes into contact with patients, infectious material. This is from the CEO doing rounds at the hospital all the way down to, you know, food service workers, et cetera. It does make a person's vaccination status a personal health record. Additionally, it collects data, which I would say the state doesn't have right now, and this is data on the vaccination rates of all healthcare facilities in the state and the declination data, why people are declining, what groups of people within the facility are declining, so we can kind of decide what's working and what's not working. I think I'll argue that if we can get vaccination rates up through this act, say to, you know, 85-90%, that we've done well, and I think we've done enough at that point. Patty's sitting here, the Hospital Association letter references that the flu vaccination rates in their facilities range from 20% to 88%. You know, so there are some facilities that are doing a good job. 88% is great. We should model that behavior, figure out what's working there, and go after that. So that's all I have today. Happy to clarify, answer any other questions.
Senator Cruz?
Is this your amendment, the dash one?
That was an amendment that came from the chair, but that is, I'm okay with that amendment.
Have you seen that amendment?
I have.
All right. Take it away.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan. I'm with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And while Chair Mona Sanderson, your amendment goes part of the way, it doesn't quite go all of the way. The association and its 58 hospitals would like to also delete an a statute, ORS 433.416 paren 3, that mirrors the language you took out of the of Jack's bill. So it's in statute. Taking it out of this bill doesn't do anything. It's also in statute, and that's what we would like deleted. As you know, and I won't give a lot of background because you've heard it before in the interim, but we would like not to make vaccinations mandated, but we're the only state that says that you cannot mandate vaccinations, flu vaccinations for healthcare workers, and that includes healthcare workers in hospitals and all other healthcare facilities, which I'm not representing. So we would just like to take out the prohibition from making it mandatory and leave it at the local level. Let every healthcare facility or hospital or long-term care facility leave it up to them to decide. And if they want to make it mandatory, then that's a management labor issue. If they have unions, it would be bargained, et cetera, et cetera. We just want to take out the prohibition that says you cannot make it a condition of employment to have a flu vaccination when you work around vulnerable people all day long. We have made many attempts to improve the vaccination rates, and Jack's right. In some hospitals, it has improved. In others, it hasn't, and we're doing education, informational, all kinds of things like that. So while everybody's working on it, the CDC recommends a 98% vaccination rate. Not sure if we'd ever get to that, but if a hospital or a healthcare facility would like to make it mandatory, we understand that the regular exemptions that are for children as well, for medical or religious purposes, would be available to those healthcare professionals, just like it is to children entering school. With that, I'll answer any questions.
Will you be... I mean, this is a step in the right direction, but doesn't go far enough, is basically what you're saying.
Chair Monis Anderson, that's correct.
Since we haven't been able to get anywhere at all in the last 4 years, how would you feel leaving it the way it is with the amendment and just keep working at it?
Chair Monis Anderson, we would oppose that.
Okay. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Jack, would you be opposed to the other deletion that she's talking about?
Absolutely. I think, let me reiterate, the reason we're bringing this forward today is because we want to raise vaccination rates for healthcare workers. We believe in that. This approach essentially brings all healthcare facilities to the table and requires them to do something. If you just delete the current statute that says you can mandate this if a facility wants to, what happens is you have some facilities in Oregon that have tried to mandate different things like masking and some other approaches that I've seen them do that in an unfair fashion that targets some populations in the hospital and not others, and then allows the vast majority of healthcare facilities that don't have an education campaign or declination form to continue to do nothing. So I think what we're bringing forward today would actually raise rates, and that's what we're trying to do.
Further discussion? What I will be doing with this bill, I don't think there's anyone else that wants, I mean, we know the issues. I will be talking with the committee members, and we will schedule a work session on Monday, and we will see where the votes are on the committee. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. On the schedule for Friday. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'll close the informational meeting relating to flu vaccines and open a informational meeting on Senate Bill 1504. Yeah, John Powell. And colleagues, if you will remember, Senate Bill, is this Senate Bill 89?
Yes.
Yeah, the Senate Bill 89 and all the federal regulations that came forward, and there were some changes, and I think Mr. Powell has worked with DCBS on this particular amendment.
Madam Chair, if you remember, we knew it was a moving target.
It was a moving target, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon.
This bill is a consensus bill, and there were some who wanted provisions in it that we could not reach consensus on. But the provisions in this bill are consensus amendments that deal with tweaks to Senate Bill 89 that, as you pointed out, passed last session. That bill dealing with the federal requirements and our state compliance with them. I'll point out the provisions in the bill. The first, and there is one amendment to the bill, again, a consensus amendment, which is the dash two amendments. On page two of the bill, in line 14, is the provision that exempts a separate notice under this provision for cancellation due to non-payment of premium. And the reason that that's exempted is there's another statute that requires notice for non-payment of premium. Without this provision, we'd have to send two notices in that instance. And this amendment allows us to operate under that other statute for non-payment of premium and notifying the person. And of course, if we fail to notify for non-payment of premium, the policy continues in that case under that statute. So the notice is absolutely required. At the bottom of page two is where the amendment comes in, and there was a what the amendment does is reestablishes the language that's been deleted on lines 42 and 43, and it changes enrollee to certificate holders, because technically in a group health insurance policy, they are certificate holders. That's usually sold through an employer, and the employees are certificate holders, not direct enrollees. So that is a technical change. The reestablishment of the language, again, allows for an averaging of the number of employees in a business, because this provision applies to groups of 20 or more. And the provisions of this deal with the plan administrator, and the plan administrators usually do not exist in real small businesses. So that's basically a status quo amendment that changes the technical term of enrollee to certificate holder.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Cruz.
You're saying it changes it, but the bill changes it. You want to go back, you want to remove certificate holders and go back to enrollee.
No. No, we want to leave certificate holder in the bill. The amendment leaves certificate holder in by inserting it on line two of the amendment. You can see that.
Oh, okay.
It deletes enrollees and inserts certificate holder. So we want to we would leave that in.
You're just moving it up. Okay.
Right.
Great. Any other further?
Yeah. Yes. Page four is an amendment that, again, that deals with group health insurance and notices to people when a policy is not being renewed or replaced. And this requires the insurer to contact the people who have been insured and tell them their rights of continuation and that sort of thing. And what this provision does is it eliminates the current statutory requirements for that notice and turns it into a rulemaking process by DCBS. So that if there needs to be changes, it can be done between sessions as opposed to waiting for a law change. And again, that would not affect that notice. In fact, it would more than likely add additional requirements to insurers to give that notice. Then on page 7 of the printed bill, there is language that deals with a liberalization of the request by an enrollee for, and there again, at a later date when we revise this, we'll going to change that to certificate holder as well throughout this language. It allows a certificate holder enrollee to express dissatisfaction with an adverse benefits determination without specifically declining any right to repeal. In essence, it allows them to communicate with the insurer without the implication that they're giving up a right to appeal this decision. And it also eliminates that it has to be a specific type of request. And that's I think, just a liberalizing correction. Then on page 10 of the bill, this is a requirement that the health plan shall give the opportunity for an enrollee to receive continued coverage for an improved and ongoing course of treatment. If they're in the middle of a treatment and there is dispute over the coverage, this makes it clear if it's an approved plan of treatment or ongoing course of treatment that's been approved, that that treatment can continue. And then the last page of the bill is the one that Legislative Council testified to at an earlier hearing during legislative days in January. And that section of the bill, because they ran out of statutory numbers, simply deals with how this will be put into the statutes in the future as a simple legal technicality.
Terrible when you run out of numbers.
Any discussion? Yes.
I think Senator Shields is first.
Are there other people signed up to testify on this bill?
This is an information.
I was just wondering if I could, Madam Chair. John, you mentioned that there were some parts that you couldn't reach consensus on. Who were those parties and what were the points of contention?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, we had requested an amendment on the first amendment on cancellation for non-payment of premium. We wanted the citation of the statute that deals with non-payment, cancellation for non-payment. We wanted that cite put into that language so it'd be clear to the reader where to go to find that. It's not necessary. It's duplicative. Legislative Council thought it was duplicative, and the Insurance Division didn't want to agree to that. So that was them. A couple health plans wanted to deal with other language in the bill that the Insurance Division either disagreed with that their language or thought it should be done in the interim when we have more time.
So you're saying the Insurance Division is okay with this bill as it is?
Madam Chair, they can definitely speak for themselves, but the indication is that they...
We'll just have them put something on the record.
Good.
Senator Moss Anderson, Chair Moss Anderson, members of the committee, Senator Shields. The Insurance Division...
Your name?
I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Anthony Behrens. I'm a senior policy analyst with the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer Business Services. And the Insurance Division is in favor of most of the provisions in this bill. I think I testified last time regarding the kind of the changes to the Clem Amendment and how when we had that Senate Bill 89 Advisory Committee for implementing the rules, that there were some consumer advocates that thought that more notice was better than less notice. And I just point that out to the committee. But there are no provisions of this bill that we oppose.
And so it doesn't address the notice requirements then? That was just kind of set aside? Or did we go forward with that over the objection of the consumer advocates?
That was set aside.
Okay.
Yeah, they didn't change that. you wanted to change it, but because there was no consensus.
No, Madam Chair and Senator Shields, that is the provision on page 2 on line 14. And this is the provision that exempts the notice under this bill because for non-payment of premium only.
That's what I want to ask.
Because
about.
The non-payment of premium is covered in another section of law, and if we do not give that notice, the coverage continues. So the only way for us to cancel that policy is to make sure that notice is given to the policy holder. So it's duplicative. If we leave this in, we have to send two notices, which we think could be confusing to a consumer, and if not consuming, very maddening.
Okay. Good. Well, we'll have more when this actually comes up for hearing, I presume. So,
I'm sorry, Chair Moss Anderson, Senator Shields. As Mr. Powell just indicated, there was some discussion during the Senate Bill 89 rulemaking that potentially these two notices could be confusing. So there was kind of back and forth on that issue. Mr. Powell is correct that insurers do have to provide a notice already under existing law when coverage is terminated for non-payment of premium. This would simply require an additional notice that is sent possibly 10 days later. And I don't know how strong the, or if you could even call it opposition, it just was a discussion that there was some benefit to perhaps that additional notice. I'm not sure if, I understand Regents has worked with Representative Clem. I've not been in those conversations, but.
Madam Chair, we have, and again, he agrees to the changes we're making. So.
Okay, Senator Bates.
Yeah, thank you. If it's confusing to us, I'm afraid it might be a little confusing to recipients too. So, yeah, John, what I'd like to see here is I want to see the other law and the administrative rules around that. That will clarify this for me. And the two issues I'm most concerned about that we see commonly is a divorced couple. Husband has insurance on the kids. He doesn't pay the premium. Mom, the kids don't know. And they end up running up a bill at a doctor's office or in a hospital, never knowing they weren't covered. It happens all the time. And the other one we're seeing more and more now, which hasn't happened to me yet, thank goodness, but a lot of people are paying their bills online. And all they do is go down the 8, 9, 10 bills for the month. They push buttons. And if they miss one button, you don't get paid and they get canceled. Okay, and we're seeing a bit of that now, and people are saying, I'm fully insured, and then you go back and check, oh, oops, I'm no longer writing checks anymore. I don't have automatic withdrawal. I'm just pushing something electronically, and they miss it. So I'd like to see how those things would actually play out in the real world with the other law that's in place. So if you can show us that in the rules associated with it, I think that might clear this up for us.
Will do.
That's good, because I did make that mistake when I was, well, not for insurance, but for my phone bill, and I forgot. And the next month I found that I hadn't paid the previous one, but it was because I put it in. But
that's why. And Madam Chair, when you get this notice, you would have a grace period to pay that.
So there. Yeah. See, and I didn't get a grace period. Yeah. Okay. All right. Good. All right. This bill is up Friday for work session, so I would like, if there's any strong opposition, I want you to let me know. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I will close the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1504 and open an informational hearing on Senate Bill 1506. And Josh Bishop and his group, I don't have the names.
Sorry, that's my fault.
You guys.
Chair
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm Josh Bishop. I'm a pharmacy director for Pacific Source Health Plans. You can introduce yourself.
And I'm Chris Bonneff, the executive director of National Alliance on Mental Illness of Oregon.
So the members of the committee, I believe, are familiar with the bill. This is an extension of Senate Bill 204, which enabled the Central Oregon Health Council. This bill would allow us to engage in a two-year pilot program to receive capitated funding for mental health medications in the Central Oregon region. We've made a lot of progress in using the Central Oregon Health Council infrastructure to integrate physical health and behavioral health. And we believe this is the next logical step to make sure that we're providing better care at a lower cost for members of Central Oregon in the Medicaid program. Since our last meeting with you, we've made one substantial amendment at the request of Senator Bates. I believe you have that. And this amendment is intending to ensure that both the authority and the health plan or coordinated care organization are held harmless if the capitation and claims are reconciled and there's greater than 1% cost difference. So the way this verbiage was written before, it really held the health plan or coordinated care organization harmless, but didn't reciprocate to the authority. We believe that this language will go both directions and make sure that there is no fiscal needed on the bill.
Chairman Sanderson.
Question, yes.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm here just to reiterate NAMI Oregon's support for this legislation. We believe it attacks an issue of quality and prescribing in the right way. It preserves access, preserves the relationship between a provider and a patient, and begins developing for this region and hopefully for the state the type of treatment algorithms that address not only the proper use of mental health medications and the individualized use of mental health medications, but the other treatments and supports that help an individual reach and maintain a recovery and a quality of life that is better than some are getting currently.
Last time you spoke before us, does the dash threes reflect the amendments that you had asked us to take care of?
Chair Mona Sanderson, I believe that in my testimony I said with amendments, but I think those had been incorporated in the LC the evening before, and I just was not privy to that.
Okay. All right. Questions? Senator Bates.
Thank you. I'm not quite sure I understand the dash threes. Maybe I'm just not reading them correctly. It's the part, of course, that I was concerned about last time of who's going to be responsible if cost overruns occur. And the way I'm reading it, it says neither the authority or the coordinated care organization or the health plan are going to be held accountable for it. So who is? I mean, who picks up the difference? If you're a capitated program and your expenses outstrip your capitation, and neither party is responsible, who picks up the difference? Do you stop distributing drugs at the end of the biennium? Do the provider somehow absorb it? What happens?
Senator Bates, that's a good question. The way I envision this language enabling us to work with the authority is to ensure that both parties either share in gains or share in losses. So that would be a negotiation between the health authority and the coordinated care organization or health plan to somehow come to an agreement on which percentage of those overruns or shortfalls are shared. So it may be reimbursement to the authority if claims are less than capitation, or it could be reimbursement to the health plan or coordinated care organization if claims exceed by greater than 1% the capitation.
Follow up?
Yes.
I'd like to hear from the authority on this plan, and I'm not sure that's what this says here. I'm not quite grasping this. It says held harmless, and I would say shared cost would be more likely a phrase or something to that nature. LC could help us with it. I just don't understand this. I don't understand this language. Did LC draft this for you?
Senator Bates, we recommended language, and they put the language in.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I'm not sure how the authority and the plan can both be held harmless.
That's what I'm going to. I don't understand the language.
You know, it's not a zero-sum game.
So Senator Bates, Senator Cruz, the intent is that we share in excessive claims or gains. So we're very open to modifying the language to that effect, whatever that might take.
Because they are equally responsible.
Okay.
I would suggest, if I could, Madam Chair,
yes,
that you have a discussion with the authority about this and try to get the language that's at least clear.
Okay.
Okay, I think I know your intent. If it's good intent, I'm fine with it, but let's get the language straight so we don't have a problem later on. I've been in these kind of situations, other issues with the authority and plans, and it's not fun to be sitting here at the desk with someone saying, you know, our rates were wrong in the capitation, and it's your fault, authority, or the authority saying, no, the capitations are right, it's your problem, you have to eat the difference. It happens very quickly and suddenly, and I just think we have to be clear about how this is going to go about.
Okay. Senator Bates, I appreciate that very much. We'll work with the LC and the Health Authority.
You do that. Also, Senator Winters had brought, and I didn't bring it, but it looks like Senator Morse has it, from Tom Burns, and I would like him to please convey what Tom Burns had sent to us.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And it's this is correspondence from Tom Burns to Senator Winters, dated February 1. Just before noon, so you probably have not had an opportunity to see this, but I think it's a response to the stated goal in the bill to improve clinical prescribing practices for the coordination of psychiatric medications in order to improve individual health and quality of life. And what Tom Burns, if I might read, Madam Chair, after discussing this issue with the sponsors of Senate Bill 516, who pointed out the problems with a 4 to 6 week delay, which obviously is unrealistic to manage quality, we revisited this issue with DMAP. Within DMAP, we have figured out a way to provide the data within 24 hours of the drug being dispensed. And I guess the question would be, does that alleviate and address some of the problems that you're trying to correct with this legislation?
Senator Montes Anderson, members of the committee, Senator Morse, we absolutely applaud the progress that the Health Authority and Senator Winters are making. It is absolutely a step in the right direction. I think there are still challenges with that approach, and I'll outline those. It moves us in the right direction, but it doesn't get us to where we'd like to be with fully integrating care and taking better care of the patient. For one thing, we are yet to determine how that will work. We have a meeting, managed care pharmacy directors from around the state with the health authority next week to determine how that might work and what the programming requirements of MMIS might be. So I think there's some administrative work that still needs to be done. We don't have any confirmation of the timeline or the costs associated with that programming. So I still have some healthy skepticism of the timeliness and reality of making that happen. Furthermore, question the integration of care for the members' experience. Every day, administering a pharmacy benefit for our members in Central Oregon experience patients who are on both physical health and mental health drugs. They call us for exceptions for an early refill or vacation overrides. We have to defer them back to the authority to take care of some of their medications. We aren't one-stop shop. We can't take care of all of the needs for our patients. So it certainly wouldn't address that. It also wouldn't integrate that data with our existing data. So as we pay claims, we get that data. We're able to run our data sets through clinical algorithms, highlighting those patients who have complications or comorbid conditions and certain medication thresholds. This is still going to create that administrative work to try and marry two data sets together and then run that through one clinical algorithm. And the last point that I would make is I don't believe that providing a daily data feed aligns the incentives operationally and fiscally to bring all parties to the same end as if you have claims paid in by one entity and separate entity operationally trying to do the right thing for the patient. I think synchronizing payment and operations is really when you're going to find that optimal outcome for the patient.
Just as a clarification,
yes,
Madam Chair, Mr. Burns did state in his email, we anticipate it will take 2 to 3 months to make these data process changes. So I've set a target date of July 1 for allowing MCOs to have access to this data. So just as a clarification.
We'll never get out of here, will we?
This provides an interesting twist to this particular bill. We had scheduled a work session for Friday, but I think that we'll still have it scheduled for Friday, but I don't think it'll maybe ready to pass out on Friday. So can you work on the amendments that have been brought up so far? And we need to probably get, I need to have a conversation with you, and then we may have to have Tom Burns come forward when we do this, and probably that should be done on Monday. But let's. Do you think we could get amendments? It depends on when.
I don't see how they can do it.
It's nebulous. Yeah, Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, I'd like to talk to Mr. Burns about this private too, because not that it needs to be a private conversation. I don't want to take time in the committee, but.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, this is not the way you go about finding what your patient's drug is. You don't. You call the pharmacist where it's dispensed at. You don't call the insurance company to find out. And they're not available nights and weekends. Some pharmacies aren't either, of course, but it's the better source is the pharmacy where it's dispensed at. You're also dealing with a very special group of clients here and patients who sometimes don't know what they're on or are confused about what they're on. And I'm not sure this is the right approach to it. Approach might be a better database that we can go into that's built at the pharmacy level, not at the payment level, such as we have with the prescribing drug bill we already have now for opiates and narcotics and other drugs. This would be an informational one so we could find out quickly and easily what a patient's on who can't talk for themselves or speak for themselves or is confused. I don't see how doing this, it's 3 o'clock in the morning in Bend and the patient's in the emergency room, I don't think the MCO is going to give you the information you want, nor is DHS. I just don't understand what you're trying to drive to here. So I'd like to have an off conversation with Mr. Burns and see what he's thinking. I don't follow this.
If I could respond, Senator Monash Anderson, Senator Bates. I concur with you, and one thing that may present a different perspective is what we're trying to do is gather that data together in a seamless database so that we can make proactive outreach for these patients. So bring our physicians and our health community health workers and our nurse case managers together and look at this patient in whole, not in part as we do today, to proactively intervene. So say we identify patients with diabetes and schizophrenia, and we realize by having timely data that's integrated that they're not taking their Abilify for the last 2 or 3 days. We can then reach out to the prescriber, make sure that they're fully informed, and they can bring that patient back in. So you're right, in an acute incident where the patient's trying to get medication, this isn't going to help that situation. We're trying to be proactive, target the right patients, and make sure that we're eliminating any gaps in care.
I don't get it.
Did you come in from Central Oregon?
I did.
I have a lot of things done.
That's why I'm just wondering if we should just not have it for work session on Friday and have it on Monday, because I don't think it's prime time yet.
Okay.
And then I need to have conversations with you in the interim, too, between now and then.
Yeah, okay.
To see, because we need votes to get it out.
It's disappointing.
Okay. Any other further discussion on this? There was no, I know that Pharma had a concern, but do you want to say anything?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Gardner, I'd like to see the final version of the amendment before I comment any further.
That's right. Okay. All right. Great. Thank you so much. I will close the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1506 and open an informational on
that would work for me.
1507. This is the HIV test, informed consent. Okay. So the groups that need to testify on this, I forget. I have Andy, and then Stacy, and that's it? Okay.
Madam Chair, Senators of the Committee, my name is Andrew Seaman. I'm a resident physician in Portland, Oregon, and I'd like to thank you once again for allowing me to come and speak on Senate Bill 1507, where we seek to diminish the real and perceived barriers to HIV screening by removing the requirement for a full, separate, informed consent process for HIV testing while maintaining an individual's ability to know they'll be tested and decline if desired. Just to review briefly what we testified on the 18th of January, both myself and my colleague, Dr. Christina Bauman, have independently attempted to start HIV screening projects and have found this consent process to be prohibitive. From an academic perspective, Dr. Todd Korthuis, who is the director of HIV research at OHSU, has looked at this question and has found on a national level and has found that physicians who live in states with more restrictive consent processes are three times more likely to list that process as a primary reason for not testing. And then finally, Michael Kaplan, who's the executive director of Cascade AIDS Project, has strongly supported this bill and specifically cited data that suggests that if we can find people, treat people, we can stop or significantly decrease this the rate of spread of this epidemic and save human and financial costs in the process. As a update, we have since the 18th had official endorsements from the Oregon chapter of the American College of Physicians and the Multnomah County Health Department, and Gary Oxman, who is the Tri-County Health Officer, has also submitted written testimony in support. We'll submit testimony from Michael Kaplan, Todd Korthuis, and myself, and Dr. Bauman, in addition to Gary Oxman. And really, that's the only update I have for you. I'd like to take questions.
Could we get Stacy ACLU up here? I know she was. Yeah.
You can ask a question before she.
Yes. Okay.
Doctor. I'm looking at this, and I support this. But one of the other rampant diseases we have out there is hepatitis C, and I would like at some point to see something similar.
Oh, it's already.
Yeah. We're already mandatory.
No.
I mean, we've already done that for
it's
C.
It's like gonorrhea and syphilis and chlamydia.
Okay.
And
Okay. So we just don't collect enough data to actually realize that it is an epidemic.
But Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, basically we're trying to make HIV closer to what the restrictions for hepatitis C already are.
Yes, Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things we looked at last time, too, was the cost of these tests, and Senator Shields actually got some information together for us, and it wasn't as cheap as we thought it was. Since that time, though, they are now perfecting a swab for the saliva of an individual to do the test. Do you know anything about that and what that cost might be like?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Bates. So there's the rapid HIV test. You can either do a whole blood sample or an oral swab. The swab, and it's actually the same rapid test. You can do both. The oral swab is and the whole bloods are, they run from the distributor somewhere around $12. Of course, the reimbursement is different. Medicare reimburse $19, and most of the private insurers will multiply about 2.5 times that as far as the cost to the patient or billed to the insurer. There are some issues with the oral swabs. They're probably slightly less specific than the whole blood tests, and so we don't use them quite as often, but they're still good tests.
Thank you.
And it's Becky.
Becky, yes.
Strauss. I called you Stacy. Sorry.
I wrote it down wrong. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I did have the opportunity to meet with Andy and Christina. Oh, Becky Strauss, I'm here representing the ACLU of Oregon, excuse me. We did have a chance to check in, and I appreciate their time getting an understanding of where we both are on this bill. I want to direct your attention to Section 1, Subsection 3. We're still going to need to oppose having this notification embedded in a general medical consent form. It's just something that we can't move on. So if that's something that the proponents and the committee is willing to consider amending, we're certainly open to continue that conversation and see if we might find compromise. I think we can be flexible on breaking down some of these burdens, the informed consent requirements that exist now, but the putting those that notification and opportunity to opt out into a general medical consent form is just something that we can't move on, and so we'll need to continue to oppose the bill if we can't address that.
Then would ACLU come forward and then to have hepatitis C and hepatitis B, et cetera, have it not be embedded in a general medical consent?
Chair Monis-Anderson, that issue is not something that I'm prepared to issue a position on from our perspective. But I would say that we continue to think that there is something unique about HIV that deserves this unique protection.
Senator Shields and then Senator...
No, I was just calling attention to Senator Stafford.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Madam Chair, thank you. As a family physician and one who provides maternity care, I know that in either 2005 or 2007, we changed the requirement about testing for HIV in women who are pregnant because of the significant risk of maternal child transmission. My sense, and it's anecdotal, and I'm curious to know if the ACLU has a different position on this, is that it has not caused significant problems by changing this from an opt-out rather to an opt from changing it from an opt-in to an opt-out for HIV testing as part of routine prenatal care. Again, to follow up on what Chair Monis-Anderson said, I'm a little puzzled as to why a disease like HIV, which can be well controlled when it's identified now, just as hepatitis C can be, where there's a significant risk of transmission if someone's unaware of their disease status, and where it can be ultimately fatal if people are unaware, should be treated differently from any other disease like that.
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Steiner-Hayward, I mean, I think that we appreciate that great risk and the benefit that early testing is going to achieve. I think that there's a trade-off here, and by moving away from the informed consent procedure, we are taking down many of the notification protections that exist right now. And I think that I'll just reiterate, putting that into the general medical consent form, I think just goes too far. We want to preserve the notification and the opportunity to opt out, and we still think that there are things unique to HIV, aside from these other things that you're calling out, hepatitis C, et cetera, that should deserve the unique protection, the unique notification, so that it's truly voluntary testing.
Madam Chair, follow up if I may. Could you please describe to us what you think is unique about HIV in this regard? I don't see, I will freely admit, I don't see it as unique compared to hepatitis C at this point, given our ability to treat both of these diseases.
Chair Monis-Anderson and Senator Steiner-Hayward, I think we've discussed in the interim hearing some of these issues, and I would reiterate kind of where I think we are on that point. I do believe that we've come a long way over the decades in destigmatizing the disease, but I think that there are still elements, for example, reporting to the state, potential discrimination in employment and other areas that simply deserve the unique separate attention.
Senator Cruz?
No question, but I would submit that Hep C and AIDS, you're dealing with the same risk pool, the same risk factors, and they're both chronic treatable diseases. And as long as we continue to treat it separate, it will not lose the stigma. And we have gone a long way to removing the stigma, which is clearly what we need to do. And so I think treating it like any other chronic treatable disease is absolutely the right way to go.
Any other further comments?
Yes, Senator Bates.
I hate to admit this, but Senator Cruz and I agree. I think this actually makes the stigma worse. It's worsening something and not helping it. I mean, we're just increasing the stigma. I mean, Magic Johnson settled this for us a long time ago. This is no longer a disease that has to be kept in a closet. We should treat like any other chronic disease and take care of it, especially its the fact that it's communicable. So I agree. It's time to move forward in this bill. Thank you.
All right. I think that you've sort of heard the consensus here on the committee. I don't think there's any major opposition. And the fact that the AIDS community wants this change, it says a great...
Easy one.
A lot to me. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And with that, I'll close the informational meeting hearing on Senate Bill 1507 and open an informational hearing on Senate Bill 1565. Lynn Bergstein, Bill Cross, please come forward. The last bill on HIV consent is listed for a work session on Friday.
Cool.
And a public hearing, yes.
Right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Len Bergstein. I'm here representing Zoom Care, and I know Bill Cross is out in the hallway, and I think he's going to be coming in. I'm here to tell you that since we last met in January, there's been tremendous progress on this bill, and I think that I can say with fairly good confidence that we've taken the controversy out of this bill in terms of the groups in this building that have been interested in this issue. We've done this with a -1 amendment that has removed the Oregon Nurses Association from the bill so that, in fact, nurse practitioners will not be dealt with this. This will be purely a physician assistance bill. We've had a considerable amount of conversations with Jack Dempsey, and he may want to give you some more insight, but he is fine with being removed from this bill. We've done some other things to also remove the controversy from the February session. The -1 also does away with the reclassification under the practitioners dispensing drug outlet. We thought that at some time with the conversations with the various groups that it would be necessary to add in a new classification and then define it. But after talking about this through and talking with Gary Schnabel at the pharmacy board, he said that his attorney felt that the existing language on drug outlet was fine for them in terms of it's all the authority they need to be able to practice and regulate in the appropriate way in this field. And then we have a -2 amendment, which is very simply an effort to clarify what it is that we are doing in terms of retaining the privilege of physician assistants to dispense controlled substances in certain medically underserved areas. And we spoke through this with the Oregon Medical Board, and Kathleen Haley asked that we kind of come together with language that would clarify how this was dealt with, and she's very comfortable with the language that you have in front of you in -2. So -1 and 2 together take the controversy, at least the rest of the building, out of this. The committee may have some issues that you want to talk about, and we're open to talk about that on Friday, hopefully, when we have a public hearing. But you asked us to kind of get this to the point where it would be non-controversial, and I think we've accomplished that with a lot of hard work on the part of the Pharmacy Coalition and some others.
Yep. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition, and as Lynn Bergstein has pointed out, the -1s are a result of a lot of effort and time that both his client, Dave Sanders, and some of our pharmacists have worked together along with the Board of Pharmacy in developing an approach that could, from the dispensing side, address some of the patient safety issues we had last session, that I think through that new section on page 2, the new language with regard to certifying with the Board of Pharmacy, registering, complying with the appropriate rules, consulting with the pharmacy, will go a long way towards addressing those issues. At this point, I cannot tell you that the Pharmacy Coalition is officially in support of the bill, but I will, by the time of the hearing, certainly let you know that we're not opposed to the bill and hopefully can, in fact, embrace this as a good approach towards
looking at practitioner dispensing policies because the landscape is changing and we're moving into, you know, changing era.
Great. All right. I love seeing consensus anyway. All right. Thank you very much. This is also scheduled, correct, for Friday for a work session. That I'll close the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1565 and open an informational hearing on Senate Bill 1580. And today, I think that we wanted, ideas for a 1580. And I think that Senator Bates and Representative Freeman are going to bring forward some issues that have been brought to my attention for the first time on Monday and then again on Tuesday. So these things are all new to me, as will be to the others on this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Alan Bates, State Senator.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Tim Freeman, our representative from House District 2 in the best parts of Josephine, Jackson, and Douglas County.
But what we do today is present not so much answers as questions and issues we've heard over the last several months since session closed, and we've been out on the road at times together, at times separately, talking to different groups all over the state about transformation. And we believe there's a set of questions that need to be answered. We expected this when we left session. We left 3650. It was pretty broad, pretty wide open. It was meant to be. When we knew we'd be reporting back in the February session with a request that we go forward with the intent of 3650, with that, some sideboards would be obviously have to be put on it. And we're in a situation now where we believe at least we know what those questions are, and our job now is to resolve those questions as best we can with the best answers we could come up with. I also would tell you that our hope is that we're going to be seeing bills from the House as well as the Senate, and that those bills will ultimately go to Ways and Means so that we can blend them together in a way that hopefully will be acceptable to both bodies and to the governor. So I'm going to walk through some issues here real quickly. Tim will interrupt me at any time to correct me, which should be quite a bit of the time. And I think he has more to offer also besides what I'm going to bring up. But I'll try to walk through these quickly. Tim, please jump in at any time. And at that point, we'll stop and take questions from the panel, or you can stop us as we go along if we're not clear what we're speaking to. So I'm going to talk about seven or eight different things very quickly here and give you an idea of the kind of issues we're trying to deal with, what we're thinking about. One of the first things that we're looking at is the question of experience and risk. A CCO, when it opens up, is going to have to some way be able to deal with the risk of the population they're serving. What that risk will look like and how it will be addressed is a key question for CCOs. We're looking more and more at a situation where the CCO is going to have some sort of a reserve in place at the beginning of the inception of the CCO. It may be a situation where that reserve can grow over a period of time. We don't know what percentage that should be on their year's book of business. Should it be 2%, 5%, or 10%? There are some federal guidelines for that. We're going to look at those carefully and try to make a reasonable decision. That will also be a discussion that goes along with stop-loss insurance. How much of that you have to buy, how much risk you have to be able to deal with your own reserves. So those questions have to be taken care of probably next week and a half. I think we have good discussions on them already. We may have to set up a program where that is decided at a later time by an outside group, not necessarily just by OHA. But we'll have those discussions in the next week and a half and be clear on them before we ask for the bill to go to the floor. Another issue.
Just to reiterate the part about the reserves and the risk sharing and the ability to manage a population and have enough reserves if you happen to get some folks that are really sick beyond what you're kind of planning for. And really around the state, we've seen many examples of organizations that have sort of figured out what their dollar amount to hold back is and have that ability to manage that risk and take on that risk and know that if they get two or three really bad or really expensive cases that they've got enough money in reserves to take care of those people. And that has evolved over time. Day one, that wasn't the case, especially in managed care. We had some managed care organizations that did not have enough in reserves and had some really expensive patients and had to come back to the legislature and ask for some help. So this has evolved over time. You have people around the state that have some of the experience to know what those dollar amounts should be. We're trying to actually talk about when a CCO forms sort of a pathway to get to the right amount of reserves so that we don't have to worry about organizations coming back to the legislature needing bailouts or needing more money.
Madam Chair, I would go forward then with the second issue, which is arbitration language.
And just for committee, if you take a look at House Bill 4153, I think you're going to be following in order pretty much what you want to, that you're telling us right
and
now.
And 4153, excuse me, Madam Chair, 4153 was just designed as a bill so that stakeholders had a spot to start putting their ideas down on paper. It's all it is. There's nothing magic about it. If there's things that people want different, we just have a vehicle that's a legislative vehicle to make those adjustments, and that's why it's being used.
And so another process question. So you plan to draft these amendments after we pass the bill out of this committee down to Ways and Means?
There may be amendments that will be discussed at this committee level between now and probably early next week. There could be, if we run into problems that they're not resolved, we could ask for more amendments in Ways and Means. I would like to see all the amendments that we need to use passed through this committee down to Ways and Means, and then amendments from the other side brought down also so we can meld the bill together.
But just to let you know, this is scheduled for a work session on Monday.
I understand that.
Okay.
And if all the amendments
we'll talk fast.
We ain't moving on Monday.
We will see. The other issue that we need to look at is arbitration language. There's a new implementation program that's been placed in our hands for the first time today. There is arbitration language there. I'm not sure that's where we need to end up at. The key question in arbitration is how you go about the process. If two entities inside a CCO can't come to an agreement on an issue, obviously primarily financial ones, what kind of a process do they go to resolve this? One of the processes that's been suggested, it's used commonly in the insurance industry and other areas, is that each side chooses an arbitrator, and those two arbitrators choose a third arbitrator, and amongst them, the arbitration is completed, and there's a time limit on it. That language needs to be, I believe, fairly concise, as we've had many times in the past where people do honestly disagree over rates or costs or other issues, and there needs to be a way of dealing with this without ending up in courts or having it come back to the Legislative Assembly to resolve or to OHA to resolve. We need a way for them to deal with this inside the CCO. Third thing is one I'm sure not many of you care much about, but I'll bring it up anyway. It's medical malpractice and tort reform. I'm not sure anybody here really cares about that, but I just thought I'd mention it in the way through. Just thought I'd throw it out there. There are various things being suggested at this point, everything from a serious blue ribbon task force to bring this back in 13 to actually try to put something into this bill at this time. You're going to see probably three or four amendments to this bill concerning this. I think they all should be looked at and discussed and carefully considered, both from a point of view of do they work to bring down defensive medicine, do they stand a constitutional challenge, and also whether or not they really answer the needs of a CCO. As a new organization stepping out there, do we need to give them some kind of tort coverage, not just give them more responsibility, more cost, more at risk, but do they need help? Those are tough questions to answer real quickly, but they're ones that we should have a discussion about, and I look forward to that discussion. Where it ends up in this session, I'm not going to try to predict.
And Senator Bates might have undersold that particular topic. It seems to be something we really do very much need to try to figure out now, sooner rather than later, to the extent that we have time to do it and get language together that can be agreed upon by the majority of the folks involved. It's very important to work on it.
Madam Chair, I just suggest, and Senator Bates knows this, if we create another serious blue ribbon task force on tort reform, it will be the 150th task force in 20 years, and we'll come to the same conclusions.
And I am happy with my task force language being removed. It was just a placeholder so we could have this discussion.
We'll
it was not in the LCs that were dropped in health care committees. I just wanted something on paper.
I would just comment on one of the options that is an empty shell and accomplishes nothing. But anyway.
I'm going to try not to comment and just move on. the next issue that we're going to have to deal with a little more closely is the governance issue. You may remember that there was a very long and serious discussion about governance inside CCOs. And the consensus after a long and difficult time was that the majority of people on the governing board, since this is a policy board, it's not just a board of advisors, has to be those people at risk. And that is a principle which we want to maintain. However, we'll see in 4153, a little dyslexia there, that there has been a suggestion, which I think is an excellent one, and this was from Representative Freeman, that we call out certain positions in addition to that. The majority would still be from those taking risk, but we bring in physicians, nurse practitioners, or other providers directly to the board, that we'd bring in one individual from the advisory, community advisory board, and a couple of members from the community itself. I think those are excellent suggestions. The original language called just for a majority of risk takers, that still would be in place. But we weren't very specific about who else could be on the board. And I think that suggestion is one we should take very seriously and one we may want to amend into the bill from that side or this side.
So, you know, I really liked the process that the health authority board did. And I don't particularly like the idea of overturning what they have come up with. And so we, I mean, they've spent months on this. And then to come up with these new ideas on our own without going to the policy board first, I'd like you to answer that.
Great question. Thank you, Chair Moss Anderson. The bill we passed last session asked the health authority to do some of this work. It did not ask the policy board to do any of this work. So I appreciate that they did the work, and I've attended their meetings and have communicated with them, and I don't believe anything we're doing here goes against things that we've talked about openly in their meeting. The idea of this addition to those that are going to be on the board really came out of stakeholder groups talking about wanting more transparency, more community involvement, and more of a role for the Community Advisory Council to play, which were all things that the Health Policy Board talked about. So even though maybe they didn't come back with that specific language, I would be hard-pressed to believe that they would not think that that language would be suitable for a minimum standard for a CCO board. So I I'm happy to ask them that if that's the desire. But really, their function was more of as a work group for the Oregon Health Authority, less as a work group for the legislature. The bill did not call for them to be a work group.
Well, they had a lot of subgroups. They spent a lot of time in process, and so it would be. I would love to see what the particular subcommittees that worked on various issues, whether it was your governance or tort or experience and risk, et cetera, you know, what their feedback was on those things.
I'm happy to seek that out.
And I will join them in doing that, Madam Chair. the things called out in 4135 are minimal, not maximal. It doesn't restrict anything. It says we'd like to have at least these people as a minimum on that board. So I will go back and review that with the Health Policy Board, too. But we haven't got a lot of time for this, but I'll do it as quickly as I can.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
While we're at this little break, I want to back up just a minute to the arbitration piece, because we've talked about non-discrimination and several different types of appeal processes. And I've thought about that, about having appeals here, appeals here, appeals there sort of thing. Was any thought given to kind of trying to consolidate all that and maybe taking it to U of O, who has a very fine dispute resolution process?
That's why we're having, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that's why we're having this discussion, looking for ideas. We'll put that one down. It might be a valuable way of doing it. Hadn't thought of that. They do have a great dispute resolution process over there, and it hadn't crossed my mind, at least, maybe others. We'll put that in the
pot. Just a thought. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Morris.
A question. For existing MCOs, is there statutory direction for who is on their Board of Governance?
No, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, Senator Morris, no, there isn't. And some have chosen to have community members on, and some haven't. This would be a change. I know of a couple that have just recently, the last 3 or 4 years, put community members on it, and they found it was really helpful to them. But many of them are for-profits, and they have been closed and not had community members on them. I think this is a little bit different kind of an organization, a little broader, and probably having community members has value. Again, my own opinion on this only, those at risk still have to be the majority.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I agree with that, but as we went through the process of transformation, you guys were all on the Healthcare Joint Committee, and when we had these discussions, we continued to talk about community buy-in and community ownership. And to me, having the people that are financially at risk being the majority makes sense from a financial perspective, but from a community ownership perspective, having some community members at large really adds to that more of a broader community buy-in. I think it will be important to have these successful entities in our communities.
I would agree.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I'm going to express a little bit of ignorance. The implementation plan, which is about a 90-page document, was given to me this afternoon. And I'm going to go back and review very carefully in that the specific recommendations by the Health Policy Board as far as this makeup is concerned. And I'll talk to them and get back to you also. Is that adequate?
Oh, this is, I like 1580 as it is, okay.
Okay.
I think that some of these issues that you're bringing up are things that can be addressed, but in a 35-day span is really tough for me. But this is why we're here, so keep going.
Madam Chair, I'd offer that I think that it's the level at which we address them is going to be important. We may call out that they should be addressed and how they should, the process for doing it. We may not address specifically what happens. As an example, I don't see us saying that your reserve has to be 2.37%, type of thing. It's, let's set up a process that we get there with the understanding that you have to have reserves going in. Something of that nature is what I think I'm thinking of. I hope you don't think we're going to fine-tune this and micromanage it from a 10 to 15-day discussion.
Well, there's a lot of federal money involved in this first year, and so we don't know how that money is going to be distributed, but if we fast-track certain CCOs, they probably will be able, and again, I'll have to ask the health authority, be able to take advantage. Take that. Money talks, in this industry. And
we very much believe that we're going to put in place a carrot, not a stick type scenario, where we do have enhanced reimbursements for those that are forming a CCO or fully have formed a CCO. You used a term that I want to be a little careful. Even in the bill that I wrote, the word fast track is not in there. The words that were coming right from our work group, Wednesday nights, and from our work as a transformation committee. The words early adopters are in there, and I don't want to get those things confused. It seemed a little odd to me that the health authority liked early adopters, but they don't like fast track. All that being said, I clearly admit that that wordage isn't right yet, that we need to have one set of criteria for people to meet, and that criteria should be the same for those that are early adopters or those that take a little more time to get together and very much want to get that language right. And really the emphasis of that particular language was around using some of the experience of the existing providers throughout our state that have done very well at this and not discounting that experience that they have. So I apologize that got muddied up in the two tracks, but we will work to get that cleaned up.
But can you, I mean, I come from the metro area and you don't, and I mean, the fact that there are some managed care organizations, I think, that are ready to be a CCO in the Tri-County area. We also have a group of county hospitals, an MCO, now more than one MCO. The Tri-County area is extremely complex. And what's your input on how they may want to address the CCO? Because they won't be ready July 1 if they go under the umbrella.
Madam Chair, thank you for the segue into my last point. Okay, because that's exactly where we're going with this. As we've watched this develop around the state, it appears that in geographically defined areas, which are actually out there in the state. In Southern Oregon, there's probably two areas, mine and the Roseburg area, maybe over into Cloud Falls. There's Eastern Oregon. There are certain coastal regions. There's Eugene and, to a degree, Salem. And then there's the other half, literally the other half of the state as far as population is concerned. Frank, Senator Morse, I'm sorry I left out the Good Samaritan system, which is really out there in front of this, so I apologize for that. Larry Mullins will come here and beat me over the head in a few minutes. When we look at the Tri-County area, it is a very different situation. It's half the state, a massive population, very concentrated, not easily geographically defined from a point of view of medical terms, not from how the population moves amongst itself and how much those different areas of the state of the Tri-County area is different. I know there are different neighborhoods that are very different from each other. But it's a very different kind of situation. It's going to be much more difficult to deal with. There's issues here that have to be addressed, or at least discussed, and potentially addressed in the language of the final bill coming out. Some of those issues I'll just touch on real quickly. One, there's real concern in the community that providers are not involved very much as far as discussion of what's going forward. And when I say providers, I'm talking about nurse practitioners, talking about physicians. I'm not talking about hospital groups. I'm not talking about MCOs. Those seem to be at the table pretty well, but other groups don't seem to be there, and there's a real concern about that. I think that's been touched on not only here but elsewhere, and that needs to be changed. Other issues involved in this is whether there should be more than one CCO in an area this large. Should patients and providers have a choice of doing work with one CCO versus another CCO? Some people would like to see a single CCO for the entire Tri-County area. Others would like to see at least two. And that's a discussion that's going to have to occur over the next week and a half. When you're in a smaller geographical area and a CCO is having friction with its providers or others, it's pretty easy to sit down and talk with the people on the board and that group. But when you're in an area, as you've pointed out, Senator, that's as big as this one is, with as many people, it's a little different story. It's really difficult to get down to it sometimes when you have issues going on. So we're looking very carefully, thinking very carefully, listening to a lot of people and what this means for the Tri-County area, which may mean something quite different from any place else. And we're not going to get this resolved if we don't have that discussion. We can't just let things roll along and hope that it'll work out. It's going to be a robust discussion about what happens in this area. And I've only touched on a couple of the issues. There are others out there. And one of the questions for us is going to be, how far do we go in legislation in defining what happens in this Tri-County area? I'm not sure where we should be at yet. I want to listen to a lot more people on it. and we want to put a product out that we can have at least a consensus on, if not an absolute 100% vote on.
And Senator Moniz Anderson, thank you for bringing up the issues that could be very challenging in the Tri-County area. And I liked your description of the Tri-County area. It would be much more politically correct than mine. So thank you for that. The idea and the history shows us that it does work a little better up there if there is some options for both patients and providers. We've seen the ability for more than one hospital system, more than one managed care organization, and then, of course, with the three counties all participating, it really has had to evolve in the current system of several different places for people to receive care. And I don't see anything yet that tells me it's going to be any different than that. I think there's going to need to be that, sort of a more than one approach and not putting all of our eggs in one basket. I think that would be very risky to say we're going to have just one entity do half of the state and population. So I'm looking forward to hearing, as Dr. Bates said, some ideas around how we frame that. But I do believe there will be some great innovative solutions that come out of Portland. Not only do they have half the population of the state, they do have some very smart people there that are working very hard to help figure this out.
Yeah, I wish you had amendments for us to look at.
We will soon. Amendments are being drafted as we're speaking. Yeah. We'd like to bring those to this committee so you can look at it before we even come back into committee.
Because I am just concerned. I truly want to pass this out on Monday. I mean, I'm saying that. I truly do. And Ways and Means needs this bill, and especially with what's coming from the House.
Oh, yeah.
And so, and we only have 35 days. And if we start hassling all of these amendments, that wasn't the intent. We had the health board. We had health policy board. They've worked months and months on a product that is very, very good. I think that some of your issues definitely need to be addressed. I don't know why it would really have to be addressed in this 35 days, because I do believe that these issues should be talked about. But
Chair Monzanos, I would tell you that they don't necessarily all have to be addressed. But I think we need to have a discussion about them at least, and make sure that people are heard about this, because many people feel very strongly about these issues. We need to listen to them and hear them and let them know they were heard. But looming behind all this is exactly what you said. We have a $700 million shortfall in the second half of this biennium when you talk about total funds. We have an opportunity here with transformation and the formation of CCOs to fill probably $500 million of that, or close to it. That money will not have any chance of coming forth from the federal government if we do not pass transformation and authorize CCOs. And I am not willing to throw transformation under the bus for, frankly, any of these issues. I want to make this bill as good as we possibly can. I want us to go into the next session with a financial backing that will allow us to complete the biennium. And I want us to have an opportunity in 2013 that those issues we haven't fulfilled here, and extra experience we'll have by then with CCOs having started up and running, that we can deal with those issues at that time that we leave unfulfilled at this point. I don't necessarily expect to have a perfect bill coming out of Ways and Means that answers all seven or eight of these issues, but I think it's important these people be heard, and that's what we're trying to do today.
I've had these issues. I've just since Monday learned a lot about them, and I really think that there's value to them. I'm just concerned what we can get through in our limited amount of time.
Madam Chair, I would agree. We'll get as much done as we can. It won't be perfect, and it doesn't have to be perfect, not for what we're trying to do here.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm glad that you've focused on the challenges in the Tri-County area. It's about 40% of the Medicaid dollars, best I can tell. It's been a while since I've been on the full Ways and Means Committee. Do you have a sense of how many members from the Tri-County area are on the full Ways and Means Committee? I can't remember.
On full Ways and Means?
Yeah.
I will do a head count for you. I know they're all, here's the important thing from my point of view, they're all from Oregon.
Well, the house.
You know, they're all from Oregon. And I think in the end, I don't mean this facetiously, it's going to sound that way. In the end, we're going to do what's best for the entire state, and that includes the Tri-County area. And when you look at the difference between Southern Oregon and Bend, and between Medford and Roseburg even, there's huge differences out there. It's more acute in the Tri-County area, and I appreciate that. But we're not going to lose transformation over these issues. We're going to do the best we can to deal with these and move transformation on through.
I concur with your view. I think what I'm more comfortable with is trying to sprint as fast as we can until Monday, try to get as much of this done here rather than sending as much of that down to Ways and Means where...
Thank you.
Where it's less certain.
More gets done here, the less it is for us to do down there.
So let's get to work. That's my point.
Senator Cruz.
In all due respect to our presenters here, we have gone in a really bad direction the last couple sessions, and that is we'll send bills to Ways and Means and we'll amend them in Ways and Means. Ways and Means is a policy, is not a policy body, it's a budget body. And I think we keep this bill in the policy committees where they belong as long as it takes to get them right and not send them to Ways and Means. I strenuously object to the thought that we kick this out of this committee Monday. Madam Chair, that's absurd. We have too much work to do, and we need to spend the time doing it.
We have 11 bills in this committee, and transformation, to me, is... I know all of them are important, but we must have transformation. We must have transformation. Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. I'd like to ask... I'm not sure if Dr. Goldberg or Mike Bennett have anything to...
We have a public hearing for this on Friday.
Perfect. Yes, and we do have a public hearing on this all day Friday.
Well, not all day, but...
All from 3 to 5. 3:45. We have 15 minutes.
Tonight? Okay. Public meeting?
No. Friday.
I'm going to drive you crazy, aren't I?
Any difference?
Are we still friends, though?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Bonetto, Governor's Office.
A.K.A. Bennett.
Okay.
Yeah, A.K.A. Bennett. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We were here probably to answer some questions. What you have in front of you, Senate Bill 1580. Bruce and I came and talked to this committee a couple weeks ago. At that time, it was Legislative Concept 97. I think the same thing is in front of you today. We really had four main pieces. One really allowing for the implementation of CCOs and you approving the reports that have been done by the Oregon Health Authority. The second having to do really with data sharing between DCBS and OHA. The third having to do with some explicit language around provider non-discrimination. And then the fourth had to do with legislative oversight, coming back on a quarterly basis and reporting how the implementation is going. So that has not changed. It's the same language that you saw a couple weeks ago. So really happy to entertain any questions.
Well, I wanted the other group, to come forward with concerns, and I really think it's important to hear what the policy board, how they will react to changes. Well, maybe you can't really speak for the board, but there are a number of stakeholders that are coming to us wanting changes, and some of them are reasonable, and we need to talk about them. So I just need your input on the process that we're going forward, since we are, and excuse the word, fast track, because it's so important to get transformation through.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, we've had, it's been a robust public process over the, last 6 months. The original House Bill 3650 really laid out the framework.
it called for us through a meaningful public process to really come up with a variety of thoughts about how we would implement 3650. We had 8 community meetings around the state, several meetings a month generally of the Oregon Health Policy Board, lots of work that got done. It really culminated in the implementation proposal, which I think all of you have, which really outlines many of the issues, financial solvency, governance, metrics, et cetera. Obviously, I think this is a work in progress. I think we've all understood this entire process that began a year ago as not ending in this short session, but that this is really evolutionary and that we will continue to make changes to and improve on the statutory framework of 3650 and of putting together these CCOs. So I guess from our perspective, we see, you know, the work that's been done as a good start. There are a lot of issues that have been raised and no doubt will continue to get raised over the next what I would think would be couple of years. And you know, our sense is deal with the ones that we can successfully deal with now, continue the dialogue. And as you indicated, there's been a lot of work done, and I think the most important piece is to get this implemented and moving forward. And I'm confident that with the appropriate oversight from the legislature that we can continue to work on this as we move it forward.
Yes, Senator Morris.
Sure. There are a lot of threads moving here to weave into a fabric. One is the federal assistance that has been asked for. Do we have any understanding of what the minimum requirement is in legislation in order to qualify for that grant assistance?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Morse, members of the committee, I would say it's the minimum is passing a bill that moves us forward on our path towards a healthcare transformation, and along with that, the approval of an 1115 waiver. It's really the waiver. It's the combination, and we've been talking to the feds on a, now it's becoming an almost daily basis, talk with them this morning. It's the combination of legislation that details the path that gives the federal government some security in the fact that we're on a path towards some significant change and indeed better care and savings. Accompanying with that successful completion of our 1115 waiver that gives us the approval to do that. Those are really the minimum requirements.
And Chair Morris Anderson, Senator Morris, I mean, to that end, to really, I think, be explicit, if you looked at Senate Bill 1580, I mean, if you looked at Section 1, that in and of itself would be the bare minimum because that would then allow for the implementation of the actual proposal.
Correct. The CMS is well aware of 3650. They are well aware of the implementation proposal. That's what we've been working with them on. And I think so long as they get something that's a reasonable proximity of this, that's what they're expecting.
Okay. Thank you.
I feel that we have a number of placeholder bills also, that if we get a bill down to Ways and Means but then work on these other issues in the placeholder bills in the policy committee might be a way to do that. So, you know, I'm just putting that out in the public because I want to get the bill down, but I know we have two bills actually in this committee, and then we have bills in the House that are sort of placeholders to deal with some of these issues that I think are important but need a little bit more in-depth conversation. All right, Well, no further comment. We're done 8 minutes early. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll see you Friday. With that, we're adjourned.
We only meet till...